You know, everybody's got a to-do list. Drop off the dry cleaning, pick up some milk. Here's an idea. Let's save hundreds of dollars on car insurance. And the good thing is you don't have to drop off or pick up anything. All you have to do is go to geico.com, and in 15 minutes you could be saving 15% or more on car insurance. Extra money in your pocket, it just may be the most rewarding to-do you do today.
Now, Podcast One brings you Spike's Car Radio. A downloadable Cars and Coffee, hosted by writer, comedian, and automotive enthusiast, Spike Ferriston. Now, here's Spike.
Spike's Car Radio, you're listening. We're live to what? Disc, Will? Live to Disc here in Beverly Hills on a Tuesday morning, very early in the morning. Zuckerman's here. He was late. He's got some complaint about how I parked in the garage. Go ahead, give it to me. What do you have, Zuckerman? What did I do wrong?
You parked next to the handicap spot.
Okay.
And I believe that handicapped people are more likely to need a wide aperture, a wide door aperture for ingress and egress, and which increases the risk of a door ding.
So you were trying to protect me?
By telling you this,
oh,
yes.
Okay.
What did you think I was going to do?
I thought I had done something wrong.
Well, you did.
I see. But it's the Range Rover.
Okay.
I beat the crap out of that thing. You know what happened to the Range Rover? You know what I noticed? It's a very weird thing. That truck has, I think, a year of driving on it right now. And I was out in the front with the kids throwing the football or something. I'm looking at the back behind the wheels, behind the axle, and there's a big piece of plastic that, like this cover over the muffler, right? But it's hanging. It's pointing straight down.
How does that happen?
And I'm like, that doesn't look right, right? So, you know, I get under the truck. Kids are like, why aren't you playing football? I can't throw a football knowing that there's a big piece of plastic hanging off my new truck. And I get under, and these two screws, two bolts actually, were missing. And I'm looking at the thread, and it goes pretty deep, like as deep as your pinky. Look at your pinky and imagine that this is where that bolt goes into. So I'm like, that didn't just unscrew on its own because of speed bumps. Somebody stole those.
Did someone stole them, or are they still drinking at the factory?
No. Here's what I did, all right? Because I think the audience knows me at this point, and I think you know me a little bit too. I can't continue playing football with the kids until I fixed it. So I went into my garage, into my big bucket of screws and bolts that I keep like an old man, and I found two that worked perfectly
and validated you must have felt terrific.
And they were from old furniture, you know, when you put together IKEA furniture and you need
the Allen wrench,
and I had two Allen wrench bolts, and I was like, God, I'm so glad I saved these. I'm gonna be a hoarder.
Years ago Steve Levy, who you know, he bought a brand new Range Rover.
Yep.
And there was a handprint right in front of his eyes on the windscreen. And every time he took it to the car wash, that same handprint was there, and it made him enraged. He kept going back to the car wash. Will you get that handprint, or will you clean? It turned out the handprint was sandwiched in between the two pieces of laminated windshield glass drinking at the factory. They had to change the windshield on that car.
And that's what they do? The British, did they even make those things in England?
I think maybe. It's owned by an Indian company, right? Tatra?
Yeah.
Or Tata?
Tata.
Tata.
I love that truck. I'm still liking it. It's doing that thing that you and I were talking about, how you drive them a little. You know, it's usually the 10-month period where things start to loosen up a little bit, right? The car. Now, the only car I've driven that loosens up in a good way is GT3, where it really comes into its own as far as the motor and the drivetrain. But, you know, GT3, year three, we talked about the bucket seats that are rattling. Now I've got some noise in the Range Rover.
That's,
I know,
predictable.
Part of that was the plastic flapping in the back. Anyway, we have an excellent show today. We're going to do something, Zuckerman, we don't normally do. Lots of folks ask if they can just call into the podcast, and I say, no, I'm not interested in that. I don't want to be some sort of AM radio guy doing scratchy phone calls. However, I recently saw this Mission Impossible movie, right? Directed by Chris McQuarrie. Have you seen this thing?
No, you told me everything I need to know about the movie.
Fallout, right? And it had stunt sequences in it that were getting applause in the movie theater that I was in. Not, by the way, full of BMWs, which you're going to like, right? But after these sequences, the crowd in L.A., the crowd was applauding, which I don't normally hear, right? Especially in Los Angeles. Well, guess what? The next day, I'm looking at Jalopnik, and I read about the guy who's responsible about it. This fella, Justin Westbrook, writes an article with an interview with a guy who has the coolest name in show business, Wade Eastwood.
Yes.
And Wade, who is in London, I believe, shooting a movie. He might even be British. We're going to find out everything about him.
No.
He's calling in right now. Going to talk to him about Mission Impossible, Fallout, and all the stunts he arranged for the show, the BMWs, what he did to that 1986 BMW E28 5 Series.
Yes.
When it comes to technology, the difference between consumer-grade and business-class PCs is just as marked up as it is for commercial flights. And for many, the upgrade is worthwhile. Here's the difference a business-class device can make for you. Many modern consumer-grade processors and mobile operating systems prioritize battery life over processing power. Business-class PCs often offer both better performance and longer battery life, allowing users to work faster and longer while on the road. Every HP Elite PC comes with HP Elite Premium Support, providing 24/7, 365 dedicated service from US-based specialists who are dedicated solely to supporting HP Elite products. Business class devices help their users take advantage of their advanced features with free bundled software that is not available or requires an additional purchase on consumer-grade PCs. For example, HP Elite Family products come with security software and features that protect at the data, identity, and device levels to help keep proprietary data safe. To create images that have the impact you want as a graphic designer, you need a laptop with high computing power that can handle multiple functions. And when you're searching for a good laptop for graphic design, you have every right to be picky. HP has a go-to choice for graphic designers for years because our powerful laptops combine serious performance with a streamlined user experience. We strive to serve the pros, the beginners, and everyone in between. HP Elite PCs are designed to pass MIL-STD testing for and are tested for 115,000 hours to HP's own testing standards to help ensure durability. New HP EliteBook 700 series notebooks are also made with Corning Gorilla Glass and a magnesium alloy chassis that's 18 times stronger than plastic. And right now, get an extra 10% off select 8th generation Intel-powered HP PCs with Spike, that's me, until September 17th. When you go to hp.com/spike, that's hp.com/SPIKE, you're using promo code SPIKE.
You're listening to Spike's Car Radio.
Very exciting. Wade.
Hi.
It's Spike.
Hey, how are you?
He sounds Australian.
No, he's South African. Hey, this is Paul Zuckerman. How are you, Wade?
Good, how are you?
Good. Get it together, Spike.
South African. It's like Australians, but with culture.
Exactly. And brains. Don't forget the brains.
A friend of Elon Musk, perhaps?
Well, you know, when it suits me.
When it suits you. Well, very nice to meet you. What are you doing in London right now?
I'm filming Men in Black redo, a new Men in Black movie with Chris Hemsworth and Tessa Thompson.
Excellent. So you are the stunt coordinator and the second unit director for this Mission Impossible Fallout, correct?
That's correct.
The movie was outstanding, by the way.
Thank you.
I was just telling Zuckerman, the audiences here in Los Angeles were applauding for your sequences.
Hey, wow.
Do you get that a lot?
I don't know. I mean, I don't.
Is that the first time you've heard that?
I hope we get it. That's the aim at the end of the day.
I just haven't heard an audience react to a movie like that in quite some time. You know, you just don't hear that.
It's timing, you know. I think the timing is people are just a little sick of the visual, you know, these big visual shows, these CG fests, if you like. And they just want a little bit of real gritty action and, you know, stay with the character and feel the action and feel the pain rather than, you know, these big sort of computer games that you watch, which are also great. But I think the audience just want a bit of realism every now and then.
So at what point, so you're working with Chris McQuarrie and Tom Cruise. At what point does the stunt coordinator come in and go, you know, I have some ideas? Or do you even do that? Do they come to you?
Yeah, so I get involved pretty early on. I was on the movie nearly 2 years, so I get involved in the early script stages with them, and on a movie like that, and we create together, because the action drives the story a lot in a Mission Impossible movie. You know, it's a lot of action in the film. So yeah, it's very much a collaborative effort from the start. I get involved very early on and help write the action sequences with McHugh and with Tom. So it's a great creative process. It's a very sort of fulfilling creative process.
Here's what I'm having trouble understanding, though, is you know, when you're sitting down, at what point in the script process, you know, is there a script that you then go in? Do they say, cool action sequence here, and we'll deal with that later? Do they really do that?
Yeah, it's normally we have an outline. We have a guide of what we want to do. And because we work together quite a lot, we know where we're going with it. But there's a guide, there's an outline. This is what we need. This is this is what we have to achieve. This is the mission objective. And it's how we do it. And we don't just create a whole bunch of action for the sake of it. We create a sequence at a time as the story evolves. And then we see where it takes the character. And if it's taking them to a good place, we carry on down that path. If it's taking them to a place that's action for the sake of action, then we bring it back to story and character again, and try and keep the emotion and that sort of subjective filmmaking approach, and take it back along that path. So we keep pushing. I push one side, Chris pushes another, Tom pushes another, and together, you know, we all seem to push in the same direction.
My impression of Tom seems to be he pushes harder than anybody else.
He pushes hard. You know, we all push hard, though. He's, he's 100%, you know, which is what you'd expect from him. He's just very passionate about it. You know, he loves it. It's his life. He really loves it. He loves film.
Now, before we get to the BMW sequence, were you also in charge of the sequence where he's jumping building to building and he famously missed and broke his ankle?
Yes, I was. Yeah, I was. I did the whole movie, so beginning to end. Yeah, as the second year director and stunt coordinator. So it's two sides to it. You know, you're there on the action and setting camera, as well as you're there on the coordination. So you know, it works throughout the whole film.
So take me through that moment. You know,
that was the smallest sort of stunt of the film, if you like. I mean, it was after what we did. I mean, dropping him out of helicopters for real and all sorts of things. nothing was fake. Nothing was green screen. So that was by far the smallest stunt, and we've done stuff like that with Tom before. It was, you know, you have a line obviously to stop you falling to your death, and you have another one to stop you hitting too hard, but making it look like you hit too hard.
Oh my God!
But what you can't control are the limbs. You know, the limbs are down to the person doing it. And we did a whole bunch of jumps with a double for lining up the cameras, and did 30 odd jumps. It was all fine, and three or four with Tom, which he was great. It was really good. But he really always wants that extra 5%, that extra something. He wants the audience to believe that it's not fake. Like, he really is jumping. So we're not helping him with assists, and we're not giving him little pops with a ratchet and stuff. He's having to run at that pace to make that jump as if it's for real, as if his life really does depend on it. And if it's fake, you can be the best actor in the world, but the audience still see from your body language. So he just we sort of got it, but he just wanted that one more. He just wanted to reach, and we said, just make sure when you reach, you don't stay reached for too long, because obviously your leg's way out in front of where the body's going to stop. You know,
right.
And he just held it a bit too long. And he locked the leg, and same that can happen with a stunt double very easily. But Tom just gives 110% performance, and he was so concentrated on that camera angle, looking at him, and that, you know, that leap and having that perfect profile. And if you look at that profile on the shot, I mean, it is the perfect leap. You know, the one leg tied back, the other one fully outstretched. He really went for it, 110%. And he just stayed extended that nanosecond too long. And it you know, bent the foot back in a funny angle and did that. And it's one of those things. I mean, he was so apologetic afterwards to everyone, but, you know, didn't need to be. It wasn't his fault. You can't blame the guy for giving, you know, 110% every day. So it was, it was good. And also, in all fairness, the film needed it. You know, we were bottlenecking on the schedule so badly, and we had so much stuff to shoot, and we really needed a little break. I think the crew's also wanted it. Yeah, well, welcome the family time, a little R&R, you know, with the family. So we were all more than happy.
After he plants the landing, he climbs up, he limps away. Was that an authentic limp, or was he acting that limp?
No, that was 100% authentic. I mean,
oh, jeez, because it hurt. I was hurting in the audience watching it.
the talus is a funny bone, you know. I wouldn't have appreciated the pain as much. I broke my talus on the same job about 2 months prior to Tom. Mine, unfortunately, he reminds me constantly, was on the weekend doing motocross and having fun, not at work like his. But it's the worst bone I've ever broken in my life.
The
talus is not the funny bone. The funny bone's in your elbow, but the talus is the funny bone.
He was saying it was a funny bone to break, not the funny bone. Zuckerman is a personal injury attorney, so he deals with breaks and injuries.
I'm salivating.
No, it's definitely not a funny bone to break. There is no fun about breaking it. There's very little blood flow to it, so it stays broken a long time, and it's a real hard one to heal and because all your weight's on it every day. It's the your main bones from your leg go straight down into the talus and the subtalar joint. So it's really difficult. And to get up, I mean, I did mine at motocross and I tried to stand and I fell over. And he, to be able to limp past camera like he did was, I'll give him credit where credit's due, and there's credit due there. It was pretty amazing to do that.
This is fascinating. It sounds like for what might have been some number of seconds of a jump sequence, so much thought went into how to mechanically pull off this stunt, how the stunt looks, body position, etc. How much time did you spend figuring out this jump sequence?
The jump sequence, not long at all. You know, we rehearsed the day before with the double, just to line it up.
A few seconds, 5 minutes.
The jumping from building to building in our job, in our business, you know, you've got a good team behind you and stuff. It's not rocket science, but the reason missions are the way they are and Tom's the way he is we're not looking at just jumping across a building. We could have done that in one shot. We really want to take the audience on the journey with us, and he really pushes for that little bit of detail, that how do we keep them engaged? So it's not just a stunt. It's not just a wide shot of a stunt and Tom Cruise doing a stunt, because he doesn't do them just to make the papers. He makes the paper enough being Tom Cruise. He doesn't need to do all these stunts. It's not ego driven at all. He does them because he loves them. And if they fit the story, he just wants to do it. So that's where I think Mission and Tom differentiate from others. It's the small details, like the perfect body position, you know, and that sort of that energy that you can't fake when you desperately, if you were doing that for real and there's, you know, 100 foot below you or something, you're going to be pulling that face and stretching that far to make sure you make that jump. That's for sure. And if you're on a wire and you feel super comfortable and it's like, oh, I've got a little bit of assist, the stunt rigger's jumping on the line or popping the button and he's going to give me the little extra 10-foot jump, you know, you can see it. And I think that's what makes it different.
So BMW decides to sponsor this movie, right? They're going to provide all the vehicles. Is that how it works? Because I thought I saw some old Land Rovers in there too. Like, take us through like the manufacturer deal. Who puts that together, and how is it brought to you?
That is beyond me. BMW have a relationship with Mission Impossible, with the franchise, and with Tom. The ins and outs of it, I don't know. All I know is we get lots of really cool BMW M spec toys to play with.
You premiered the new M5 in the movie, but the centerpiece scene is this 86 BMW 5 Series, this E28, right?
Love that car, the E28.
Let me just ask you, how does that car get introduced to script? Is that you doing that? Is it like?
It's a collaboration. So the production designer, Peter Wenham, who's phenomenal, he's also a bit of a petrolhead, a bit of a car nut. So he starts looking at pictures of cars and things that the design-wise fit into the film. And because obviously it's action-based and I'm an absolute car nut too, I race cars and stuff. So we had a close relationship looking at cars, and he bought the E28. He bought a whole bunch of cars, and then he bought the E28 in. And I was like, it has to be this car. I mean, this was a car produced only in that era, Germany and South Africa, and South Africa where I'm from.
Right.
I remember it being launched. It was an absolute epic car, drift car. It was just great, bulletproof. So I'm like, we've got to do it. And it came in this like weird green, and everyone was like, yeah, well, here's the colors. We're going to spray it in. And I was like, don't touch it. Just show McHugh this color, because against the cobble streets in Paris and the textures of the buildings and the lead doming and all the stuff that you get in those old cities, just leave it as it is and let him see. And McHugh walked up straight away and was like, this is a great color, great car. Especially when you put all those guys in it. I mean, it's hilarious.
And You didn't modify it in any way? I mean, I'm sure you modified things for stunts, but when I saw the wheel spin and the drifting like you're talking about, I thought, well, they've done something to the engine. Or they've nothing.
Nothing. We just made sure it was, you know, service, made sure it was running nicely and cleaned it all up.
And is Tom doing the drifts?
Tom does everything. 100%. I mean,
I'm in awe.
We did his drifting on Rogue Nation. You know, we really took it to another level with the M3s. And Tom's, you know, great car guy. He can race and he's very quick. But drifting's a different art. And so, you know, I have quite a drifting background through my work. So I taught him drifting on Rogue Nation, and he just got better and better and better. And he got so precise with his drifting that he was so safe around camera crews and people on set that we could put cameras in much better dynamic, you know, positions. Because we knew that he was always going to hit his marks and be safe. So
right.
With Mission 6, with Fallout, we just picked up where we left off on Rogue Nation and took it to another level. Obviously, the E28, the older M5, has a slightly different body roll and different, you know, different mannerisms. So I put him on really unique little twisty circuits, almost go-kart track circuits, and try to get him really used to the body roll of the car and weight transfer and shift, and he got it straight away. He just adapted to where he was with the M3. And then, yeah, everything you see on that movie is Tom, whether it's driving, riding bikes, skydiving, helicopter flying. There's no cheating at all, ever.
Wait, and what about – how many cars did you use for that scene, the 5 Series?
I can't remember. I think it was about 5 or 6.
Were they all – did you find all the same color, or did you paint the other 5 the same color?
Yeah, we painted the other 5 to match.
Oh, you did. And where are those cars? Could we buy those cars? Are those available?
I've been wanting to buy them too, actually, because I think the price is going up.
Yeah, I mean, they're so cool, and you know, because it instantly I started thinking of just historic film sequences with cars, like the Bullet Mustang, and this car for me slots right into that category because of that scene. You know what? You know, again, where I was sitting out at the Grove with my family on a Saturday watching this movie, the theater went nuts at the end of the sequence. They went crazy, applauding Zuckerman. Tourists applauding for a BMW 5 Series.
And you mocked me when I bought one.
I'm still mocking you.
How iconic it was, you know. It's a great car. It's bulletproof. Mm-hmm. I mean, and then the new M5 as well. I got to do all the drifting in the new M5 and that, you know, the radio controlled scene when it's being driven in, you know.
Mm-hmm. Do they give you cars? Do you get a free car for doing all this for them?
Me, no, I don't.
Oh, come on.
Let's renegotiate. This is unacceptable.
I used to get bikes from them. And then I got Triumph, who's an amazing brand, have come forward with a great company, you know, Triumph, the new bikes, the new Speed Triple, and, you know, they're just making some great bikes. So I just, trying them for a while.
Let me ask you about the next best sequence, which had my head kind of scratching. I've now read about this and I kind of know how you did it, but the BMW R9T sequence in Paris, where where Tom is flying around on that motorcycle around the Arc de Triomphe, right?
Yeah.
While there are cars spinning around. Now, first of all, the R9T, it looked like a scrambler, but it was colored like an R19 Pure. It had the gray gas tank.
Yeah, so I'm a bike nut too. I love my bike. So it was originally going to be a different bike. And because we've done on Rogue Nation, we did the sports bike, you know, with the RR, and we've done all that. Mm-hmm. I really felt that it could be something a bit more urban. Get Tom this body position a little more upright and just be a little, just have that real look to it, you know, that again with the cobbled streets and being in Paris and with the green of the M5. And so I got, when we first came, we had Peter Wenham just sort of match it almost to this sort of old look, exactly like you said, and the old Triumphy look as well. And we sort of made a little hybrid of it, and it just the bike was great. I mean,
yeah, it's sick. Now the sequence. When I was watching it, I went, wow, that's great CGI, because it really looks like Tom Cruise is riding this motorcycle between 300 cars at a very high speed. But I know what he's about to say, Zuckerman.
It was him.
It was him doing it, and it's insane.
Yeah, it was.
How do you pull that one off? You're in a location that somehow you're locking down a very difficult to lock down location. How long do you have the Arc de Triomphe to shoot your movie with?
So we had very, very strict
yeah.
Guidelines with the Arc de Triomphe. And it was amazing because we were there, you know, watching the sunrise. I remember I was sitting on a bench waiting for the sunrise.
No kidding.
As stressful as it was, it has to make you smile. I mean, you're in the middle of Paris. You're about to own the Arc de Triomphe for an hour.
Oh, and that's awesome.
It was incredible, actually. The pictures are phenomenal from that morning. But, yeah, so basically we had an hour. I have my team of drivers that I use, stunt drivers, and I also have a team of racing drivers that I use. And so I got all the guys together, and I had
Can I just interrupt you right there? Your team of drivers, how many drivers was that, 70, 80?
85 or something.
I think I had in the There needs to be a documentary of just filming this scene.
Yeah, how do you have 85 drivers that you know in Paris to get up at 4 in the morning? Who are these guys?
I had some from Paris. I had loads from England and South Africa and all over
really?
The place. I had all racing drivers from everywhere and stunt drivers from everywhere.
So they were all race drivers and stunt drivers? Or there were no teenage extras who were just at Central Casting?
No teenage extras.
It's okay. A call like in the Fast and Furious. The call goes out for the drivers.
Could Zuckerman and I have been driving in that sequence? Can we get on this list?
You'll have to pass the test.
All right, fair enough. So continue. So how do you obviously the goal is do not kill Tom Cruise. Please do not get in Tom Cruise's way. 85 drivers at 5 in the morning. How do you pull that off?
So we had they gave us the arc at a certain time, and what I've designed is that all the drivers will do a circles, so we'll have an inner circle, a middle circle, an outer circle, and they will go into their circles and do the same rotation, so no stopping. So full tanks of fuel, bottle of water in the car, they're not stopping. And they're going to do certain speeds. Each circle is going to do certain speeds because, with the shot, the tighter you get, the speeds look more intense. The wider you get, you need slightly, faster speeds to match. So everyone was setting their speeds, and then certain cars were set with lane changes. And this system, I just ran for a solid hour. So I never caught cut. I never broke the guys. They just did it for a solid hour. Tom would then enter that system, do the shot, and exit that system like a wheel. And he would go and they would check the shot. They would, have some water, coffee, whatever they wanted to do, come back in and do it again. And we'd do it as many takes as we wanted, but the drivers never changed rhythm so that Tom could get used to exactly. So if he entered a certain time, he knows that this corner of that car is going to pull out in front. This one's going to do that. So it's not boring. So it's not just cars going around and around with no changing in lanes and no nothing, So that's how I did it.
Did anybody get dizzy just driving in a circle for an hour? You're talking about one straight hour in a circle. At what speed?
Oh, different speeds, 30 mile an hour, 40 mile an hour, whatever it is, 60 mile an hour. But
no bathroom breaks for anybody. Just get in the car and go.
It must not be a nice boss because I actually never stopped to ask if anyone got dizzy.
I just want to know, how do you become the Mission Impossible guy? Where did you start and how do you get to this place where you're running Mission Impossible?
He also races Formula 3. But it's a very good point because, we're talking – when you think of stunts, you go, well, that's easy. But it's not. It's skydiving. It's holding on to the side of airplanes. It's jumping from building to building.
Did you raise your hand in second grade and say, I want to be a stunt coordinator? How does this happen?
I think it's because I didn't raise my hand in second grade that I became one.
Where do you start with
but
this
yeah, but
career?
So, but I think Zuckerman, he brings up a question that I've been wanting to ask you too. When you get into an area that you don't have expertise, how do you handle that? Like, has there been a stunt in this series where you go, clinging to sides of military transport planes is something I really haven't trained to do. So, how do you approach a stunt like that?
I think what makes a good stunt coordinator and second year director is if you've been versatile in your career. And I've always loved action and extreme sport, and growing up in South Africa in an outdoor environment, and now California, I've always been into I wanted to always be able to do everything. I wanted to be able to drive a tank, fly a plane, fly a helicopter. It's just the way I was from a kid. I've always wanted to be able to do everything. So for me, I haven't come to terms with it. I haven't had a sequence presented to me yet that I haven't had some sort of knowledge in or been able to do. I'm a helicopter pilot and a fixed wing pilot, and I drive tanks and buses and trucks and motorbikes and all that. So there's there's nothing really that in the movie, climbing or otherwise, that I can't have an opinion on or base my opinion on in creating the action. So if it did come up, I'm sure that I would then have to bring a specialist in, but I haven't had to. I mean, with the Halo sequence, I'm a sport jumper, so I haven't really jumped at 25,000 feet plus. Wow. So I brought in my military skydiving team that I've used, God, for years, since the old Tomb Raider days and everything. Alan, who's fantastic, I brought him in just to make sure that we were correct on all the equipment, making sure the oxygen was right, the lighting and the helms, everything was tested and to that military standard for doing Halo jumping. So again, that's beyond my sort of 15,000 foot sport jumping heights.
How does Halo jumping different than just jumping out of an airplane, skydiving?
Well, you need oxygen above a certain altitude.
Oh, right, right, okay. So that's the...
Yeah, and, you know, we're doing... It's nighttime jumping. Is a whole bunch of different elements to it. And, you know, Tom and the main actor doing it and stuff. So I just wanted to make sure that everything was correct and not just what I think would happen above that height.
You know, I was watching Tom with James Corden. They did a little piece on James Corden's show where they take James skydiving and all the jokes are James Corden being afraid and, oh, please. And as I'm watching it and I'm laughing, I'm like, this is really amazing. It's an amazing little bit of business for a late night show. I'm starting to notice just Tom Cruise cruising down just fine, doing all these jokes, flying around the air, flying around James Corden. And again, I'm going, wait, what am I looking at here? Tom Cruise really knows how to do this. He's so comfortable up in the air. He's turning on his back. He's kicking up his legs. Have you seen this, Zuckerman?
I have not.
It's shocking how good he is.
I think it's the funniest thing that's been on for a long time.
Yeah.
I
mean, it's quite a bit.
It's laughed out loud. I actually watched part of it here in Warner Brothers. We're here in London. I watched part of it and FaceTimed and sent videos to Tom about it, and it was just so we could share it with the team, because, you know, he's very fond of my stunt team and they've been with me a long time. It's like a big family. So we laughed like uncontrollably watching that.
Does Tom have a Ford GT by any chance?
Does he have a Ford GT?
I heard a rumor he bought John Cena's Ford GT. We've been trying to track that car down for a while.
He might have it. I know he's got a nice Shelby. He's got some nice little things. He's got a few little things tucked away, I think. He's not a big show guy, you know?
Right, right. Of course. No, he's just diving out of airplanes and movies.
Exactly.
We got to get him to come in here, Zach. And we got to get Tom to come in here and talk about cars. It would be awesome. All right. I have a couple more questions, and then I'm going to let you go. You know, I was going through your resume and looking at all the movies that you've been a stunt coordinator for. Very impressive. Mr. and Mrs. Smith, The Mummy, great movies. But then a few that I went, well, why do you need a stunt coordinator for Marmaduke?
I was a stunt coordinator on Marmaduke.
What, Bridesmaids? Were you?
Bridesmaids, yeah. It was great fun. The producer was a friend of mine. He's like, we got a scene with some cars screeching around, and then she falls over in the street, and there's a whole bunch of little stuff. It was small stuff. It was like, I was in LA at home. It was like, go down for the weekend, 2 days here, 3 days there, set it up. It's a pleasure because there's no work. There's not a lot of work in LA. You know, it's all
right. Right.
So for
Bridesmaids, you're just helping them with little falls here and there and how to execute those.
How to make it cool so it looks like the car's, and, you know, going to run her over, and it's Jeopardy and it's comedy and it's fun. And how do we do it? And it's like, you know, go in there for a week or something and set up some stuff. It's a pleasure. You know, I'm not because I do Mission Impossibles and stuff. I'm not suddenly, you know, too big or too proud that I can't do a fun comedy or a fun show, or, you know, I do fun stuff. I love my job.
Sure. Well, Bridesmaids is a great movie. I just didn't remember big stunts in it. Before I let you go, I want to hear about Men in Black, which is one of my favorite franchises. My kids love this franchise. I'm guessing this is a big reboot. Who do we have starring in it?
So this is Chris Hemsworth and Tessa Thompson.
There you go. From Westworld.
Yeah, and it's. I mean, Chris is hilarious.
Yeah.
I mean, off camera, he's hilarious. He's just a great guy. So, super cool guy. And Tess is lovely too. It's good energy. You know, they've got great energy together, and it's a lot of fun.
Wow. And when are we going to see that film?
I think it's next summer.
All right. Fantastic. Well, Wade, thank you so much for calling in. By the way, first person ever to call into Spike's Car Radio. That's how important you are and how much we wanted to chat with you.
Perfect.
All right, man.
Thank you.
Nice to hear from you. Thank you.
And you. Speak soon.
We'll talk to you later. You know what? Everybody has a favorite pair of jeans. The pair that fits perfectly and always looks great. The pair you wear out at night, at home, on the couch, at work, wherever. The pair I'm wearing right now to podcast. They're the go-to, do not underestimate their importance, pair of pants. No one knows this better than Wrangler, the authority on jeans. Using their expertise in comfort and durability and applying it to a new line of modern fits and styles, Wrangler jeans are made for the modern-day adventurers, the go-getters, folks who like to keep moving. Whether you ride a bike, a bronc, or a skateboard, or you're the type who walks the earth in search of something, these are the jeans for you. Classic or modern styles, a range of fits at a price that works for you, vintage re-releases. Wrangler has something for everyone, and don't forget the iconic patch and our stitched W American icons for over 70 years. Visit Wrangler.com and check out their great selection of jeans, shirts, pants, outerwear for men and women. I wear these pants. I love them. Wrangler, denim made for the modern world. Also, ladies and gentlemen, while we're talking, this isn't really an ad, but if you're going to be up in Monterey for Pebble Beach Concours, I'm hosting a Pebble Beach Concours Classic. Boy, there's a lot of words in that. Well, forum, a special episode of Spike's Car Radio. We're taping it live up there on Saturday, August 25th at 1:30 with big time TV star and former NFL player Michael Strahan. And I know what you're thinking. You're going, boy, I didn't know Michael Strahan was a collector. Well, guess what? He is. He's got a ton of cars. And here's the good news, Will. I've got five pair of tickets. Five pair of tickets. I'm not going to give you these tickets if you're not going to be up in Monterey August 24th and 25th. But if you are there, message me on Instagram at Spike Ferriston, and the first five people asking for a pair of tickets to see me and Michael Strahan break it down for an hour, you'll go for free.
You're listening to Spike's Car Radio.
That was Wade Eastwood. Good.
Shoot him up.
Stunt coordinator for Mission Impossible Fallout. And boy, he just made that BMW 5 Series nuts. You don't have that car, right?
I have a 5, not the new one.
No, the 86. The 86.
I have an E28 5 Series, and when you saw it, you looked at me and said, why, and mocked me.
What year do you have?
88.
Really?
Yes.
Where is this car?
It's
have I driven it?
It's the black one. You sat in it. You mocked me. It was in the hangar.
But it doesn't look like this car.
Well, it's not green. It's black. The only difference The only difference is that it's got the U.S. diving board safety bumpers on it. So probably the one in the movie, which I'll admit to not seeing.
You know what? There were no interior shots that I can recall.
Can you show me? Is it there on your...
Yeah, yeah. There's the car right there.
Yeah. That's the car I have.
Oh, my God.
That's the car I have. Silly.
I'm going to go hoon that thing around Century
it's
City
fantastic.
Right now.
It's got about 300 horsepower, so it's got some oomph. You got to put your foot into it to get it cooking. But the way they balance those cars pre computer nannies is so brilliant. They handle so well.
Yeah,
look at
I'm
that.
Showing Zuckerman some shots. I can't believe. I wonder if I can just find the sequence for you to watch because you know it's. You're a busy man, but
know,
you should
but
really go see this movie. This movie will make you BMW crazy.
The thought of going to the Grove, to parking in that parking lot, to being with a crowd of other zombies online, getting your ticket, getting popcorn, getting to a seat.
Well, you do that with an app. You don't have to buy your ticket anymore.
I don't see
right?
That's how long it is. I just don't go. I don't want to go.
And they have a valet. They have a very nice valet there.
I don't want to go to the Grove. I don't want to go to the farmer's market. I don't want to be there.
I had a very nice time. I had
Fairfax,
a very nice time.
Fairfax between 3rd and Beverly is not a place I want to be.
Oh, he's so grumpy.
I'm an old man.
What haven't we talked about?
Well, I'm going to tell you. I saw last night, I watched The Smoking Tire. And I rarely watch anything.
Matt Ferris.
Yes,
channel.
Matt Ferris show.
Yeah.
With you and him doing the Carrera
oh, that's
T
right.
versus the GT3 T. And I want to say... That was a really good show.
Oh,
and
thank you.
I'm very impressed. You and Farron do very well together. He is very fluent. He is a font of knowledge.
He is.
You're very good too.
And I like to make fun of him while he's doing that.
Well, you guys look like such an odd couple in the car together.
I'll tell you something. He was driving our GT3T very fast, very
tell.
Quick around and, those
and
turns.
And that's what I was going to say to you. The way he has the camera set up with inside and with a spot where there are two outside cameras and one in each mm-hmm. direction, you really get the notion of speed. And I think he can drive.
Okay, let me break down the stunt coordinating and second unit directing for what you just said, okay? Any of the exterior shots where you see cars driving, that's me.
Really?
Yeah, I'm driving the car at that point. Matt, I'm not sure I can share his video craft or not. I'm not sure he'd even care. Because it's just the two of us out there, and he does this while he's by himself, we're on this long deserted road. And he said, all right, I'm going to set the camera up. He's done this 1,000 times. It was so great because we shot this video in under 2 hours. He goes, I'm going to put the camera here. He doesn't even tell me that. He just goes, I want you to drive this way, out fast, back once, back twice, one,
right.
two, three, four, like that, and then come back. And he goes, just don't run over my camera, but get as close to it as you want, like Tom Cruise. And drive as fast as you want. So all of those shots where the cars are moving, that's me pulling out of the dirt and coming around. And by the way, in the article you wrote that I was over-revving all the time. I didn't. I over-revved once.
You didn't even over-rev.
And I was doing it because I wanted to touch nine for a little while because that's what he was asking me to do. It just went, nah, nah.
I am like you. I like to be in the power band. I like to have the RPMs up a little bit. I like
right.
to be able to have instant horsepower and torque on command. And I personally think that these GT3 engines and Porsche engines are designed for higher RPMs. You're not driving a Mustang. You're not driving a big Chevy.
No.
So I thought it was really fantastic. I could see you guys like that Carrera T. Do you think that that's a buy at, say, 115 grand?
Yeah, that's your daily. If you really need kind of a race car, light, like Porsche car to feel that you have something that's different than just your normal 911, that's your daily. You want to shift some gears. You want to drive it. It's a little squirrely in turns, and it's up higher. You would notice it right away. It's the suspension's higher, and when you turn in, you don't have as much hold in turns. So, but that's not what daily driving is about, right?
Right.
You've got something really fun to take to work and take home. I loved it. I just didn't like the color red.
Red.
Yeah, you know,
red, you and
like
red.
Your car.
I know you're a dickweed. So, because I drove a Carrera S, mm-hmm. the 2018 Carrera S, down to Mexico over the weekend,
mm-hmm.
and again, that car is set up a little higher. It's not handling at all like a GT3,
mm-hmm.
So I'm sure it's somewhat similar to that. Do you think that there is an argument that that car is going to hold value?
Well, how many did they make?
I do not know.
That would be the big question. But no,
it's got less horsepower. Could you feel that it had a base engine in
the Carrera T?
Yeah.
It's got enough to have fun. It's not thrilling. I don't know. You know
spoiled.
What I mean? We're spoiled, right? Exactly. There are very few cars that I go, oh, I better be careful. McLarens kind of make me do that, right? The GT2 RS is going to do that for sure. Cars like that, Carrera GTs, those are the ones you go, okay, I need to respect this animal,
yes.
learn how to drive it, and if I'm careless, I'm going to die in this thing,
right?
The Carrera T doesn't do that. It's fun. It's a fun car.
When you guys were in the GT3T,
yes.
that made me want to buy five.
Why?
It's so exciting to see you guys driving it, to see your reaction, to hear the noise as it's passing, approaching, and coming back. It's
yeah.
really – that was very good
filming. You know what he left out of the video, of course.
Which was?
One person died in the making of that video. A guy jumped off a bridge after we were done shooting.
Oh, we talked about that.
Remember, that was the day.
Oh, God. And I laughed because I can't get my mind around the fact that he parked his truck at the bridge.
Whoever this poor soul was,
and he said to the construction workers, hi.
He said, hi.
And then jumped off, and I keep thinking, how the dissonance of what that experience for the construction workers. A man says hello and then offs himself.
Then he jumps.
Then he jumps.
I was texting Matt yesterday about that and the video and thanking him for involving me. And he said, I think I told you this, he was pulling into his house and he went, "Oh, fuck." I went, "What?" He goes, "Oh, the garbage truck broke my Ring camera again." I'm like, the garbage truck or his security camera? He's got one of those security cameras over his door that has it. It's on a little clamp or a bracket, and then the camera looking down. I'm like, dude, well, that means you've got some good video. Send me the video.
It's the best video I've seen. Makes me so happy.
He goes, "It's the second time that's happened." I go, "Second?" I go, "All right, well, put Zuckerman on this thread. We're going to sue the city."
I just like – it's like
– Isn't it the funniest video?
It is. It's like a fuck you from the garbage man.
So you see – what you see is just the camera is pointing out to the street, and you see the green garbage truck pull up and its claw reach out and it lifts the garbage can right in front of the camera and it empties the garbage. But then as it comes down holding the garbage can, it just goes conk and hits that camera, and then the camera swings and goes down. It's a very, very satisfying image. I immediately told Matt, why is this not on your social media? That you versus the garbage man is one of the greatest battles I think you could – I mean, I would rather see that comparison than the GT3 and the Gravity. I would like to see this fight progress. And I know – come on. There's no way that guy is doing that by mistake, because Matt said he did it once, right? He then called the city and then filed a claim and never heard – surprisingly, never heard anything.
This is what happens.
But I'll bet you that guy heard about it, right? And then he's like, "I'm going to do this every week."
Yeah, because when you don't tip the garbage man at Christmas, this is what happens to you. When I was a kid, my father forgot to tip the garbage man one year.
Right.
And he used to throw – the garbage man would come. This is when we had pails and they'd jump off the back. And he would fling the garbage pails – all over the place. And my father every week would be cursing about the garbage man not leaving the pails where he was supposed to.
Yeah. No, we have good garbage men here in LA. I remember they used to stop for the kids and let the, you know, do all the garbagey things for them. And then my kids used to make me go to the garbage dump open house. Have you ever done that with little kids? It's always in the middle of July and it's always 100 degrees.
You know.
And wait, you're walking into a sanitation zone, so it just stinks. And it's all of these really unhappy parents and really happy kids, and they could give them little garbage cans. And
this is one of the saddest moments of my life. I've told you the story, I think.
Wow.
When I was
I'm listening.
Listen, when I was five,
yep.
My Aunt Irene came to me and said, "What do you want to be when you grow up?"
Right.
And I said, "I want to be a garbage man." Because I wanted to be on the back of the truck
some
jumping.
You are a garbage man,
and
Zuckerman.
She started screaming at me, "Take it back. Take it back. You're going to be a doctor or a lawyer. Going to be a doctor or a lawyer." And she called for my mother. My mother ran into the room to see what the shrieking was about. And Aunt Irene screaming at me, "Tell your mother what you said. Tell your mother what you said." And I said, and I had to confess that I wanted to be a garbage man, and then berated for having such a dream.
Well, there you heard it,
fucked
folks.
Me up for life.
When Zuckerman was five, he came out as a garbage man. And they gave him corrective therapy and turned him into a lawyer. And it worked.
It worked.
But you could be a garbage man right now, Zuckerman. You could just be your true self if you wanted to be.
Listen, if I would – actually, what I want to be right now is the valet parker. I'm going to retire, and that's going to be my hobby, because I can't stand the way people park their
cars. Do you know
cars.
What my version of that is? By the way, that was a great job. You know what you're doing every day, and it's easy to accomplish. You get it done. I wanted to be the guy that drove the road grader. You know what the road grader is?
Is tearing
that,
up the
– yeah, it has that big plow right in the center of it. That, to me, was either that or the guy on the back
of the
fire truck.
Truck.
Yeah, the steering the back. That was it, right?
Steering in the
By
back.
By the way, I would still do those jobs.
I would steer the back.
As long as I can keep my podcast and talk to all of you at home and at work and on the road, I'll take that job as a running the
you
road.
You
got to
figure at this point, they would have a computer that can drive the back of the truck.
Oh, but don't give people, me any ideas.
I just figure that they love it so much.
Yeah.
They're not giving it up. Like no. The pole.
It's not really the best system, but Porsche did adopt it in their GT3s and had it controlled by a little computer. And now we've got that rear steer. Look at that.
All right.
Maybe that's where it was inspired. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've had a We've had an odd little podcast here. We had our first little phone call. We talked to the Mission Impossible fellow, Wade Eastwood. Wade, thank you so much for chiming in. We've learned a lot about Tom Cruise.
Have to give what I think is the most important fact of Mission Impossible 6.
Okay.
Tom Cruise at his age.
Yes.
Tell everybody.
Okay. This is a really insane stat, but Wilford Brimley was younger when he made Cocoon, was younger than Tom Cruise when he made this latest Mission Impossible. Wilford Brimley was 50, 51 or 52.
And looked 100.
And Tom Cruise, who just made Mission Impossible 6, I think, he's 56. Yeah. Think about that, ladies and gentlemen. This has been Spike's Car Radio. We'll see you next week. Real quick before we go, if you're looking to buy a car, you're probably familiar with terms like MSRP. You might even know what it stands for. But what does it actually mean? The same goes for invoice, list price, and dealer price. It's enough to confuse anybody. All you're really looking for is a price that actually means something. Introducing True Price from True Car. Now you can know exactly what you'll pay for the car you want, including fees and accessories, before you even get to the dealership. True Car dealers will show you the true price on cars like the one you want, all from the comfort of home. And how do you know if your true price is a great price? Because True Car shows you what other people paid for the same car you want. And your certified dealers know this, so they set their true price competitively so they can win your business. So when you're ready to buy a new or used car, visit TrueCar to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features not available in all states.
Thanks for listening to Spike's Car Radio. Download new episodes every Wednesday on the Podcast One app or subscribe now at Apple Podcasts or PodcastOne.com.
From the mind of Martellus Bennett.
Once you pass 21, your birthdays are done.
It's Revenge of the Jocks on Podcast One.
Once you pass 23, you can't take me to Benihana's.
A no-holds-barred show about all the things that shape our world and culture.
I want to go to Africa. I've never been. I want to go full Jumanji. I'm Robin Williams and Jumanji.
I think that's like in South America, though.
Revenge of the Jocks with Martellus Bennett.
It's like trying to have sex the first time and getting it all wrong.
I think I'll keep trying.
On Podcast One and wherever you listen to podcasts.